Corrections is a catch-all for the failures of society.
Welcome to another episode of Seed Pod, an audio reflection of the communities of Maple Ridge and Pitt Meadows. I'm your host, Christian Cowley. I'm joined today by co-host Alicia and guest Jerrica Hackett, former corrections officer. But first, we're pleased to acknowledge that we are broadcasting to you from the traditional lands and unceded territories of the Catesay First Nation and the Kwantlen First Nation, who have been the stewards of this land and its rivers from time immemorial. We look forward to the journey of reconciliation with our First Nations family. This episode of Seed Pod is also recorded in the Seed Center Neighborhood House, which, as we have mentioned before, was built by Japanese-Canadian pioneers, who once made up about one-third of the area's population. These citizens were interned during World War II, a form of imprisonment, and had their rights stripped from them for many years. Lest we forget. Today, we're exploring how one local person who worked within the correction system perceives how we work with people that make mistakes in society. Jerrica Hackett is a Maple Ridge resident who worked for 9 years as a correctional officer and supervisor in maximum security correctional facilities for men. Jerrica worked in the provincial correction system. After leaving a career in custody, she next ventured into the nonprofit sector, where she managed a community residential facility, or halfway house. Jerrica has now left the world of corrections behind and is opening a tiny cafe in Port Coquitlam this year. The Good Wolf Cafe and Company was inspired by a Cherokee legend that Jerrica discovered while teaching courses to inmates as an officer. The cafe will honor the community by advocating for mental health, compassion, and kindness while donating a portion of proceeds to local charities. Although she's moved on to a new calling, Jerrica has much to say about our penal system and her own evolution from prison guard to more nuanced rehabilitation officer.
So, Jerrica, you worked in the correction system. What were some of your roles and how long did you serve in them?
So I started my career in corrections in 2011. I was freshly 20 years old, and I started working at a men's maximum security pretrial facility. I began as a living unit officer and over the years worked in different areas of the jail, such as records, programs, control. I did that for about 7 years before I was promoted to a supervisor and transferred to a sentence facility. I also did a special project at another pretrial facility. So I only ever worked with men, but I was able to do some neat projects. I did a pilot project where I checked out a nonviolent living unit concept, and I also completed a research project about meaningful social contact for separately confined inmates. So in 2020, I left custody and I moved to the community side, where I managed a halfway house for a nonprofit organization for the last year and a half. And I've now closed the doors of my corrections career and have moved on to other things.
What were the good points of being in corrections? What were the bad? And how would you prefer that system work?
There is a lot of good. There's a lot of bad. What I found when I started at the time in 2011, it was a very hardline system. So it was a lot about, it was kind of like warehousing at that time. We had very high counts on most of the units. So the ratio was 60 inmates to one officer. And it's an open living unit concept. So that means I'm sitting at the desk by myself, just turned 20 years old, and I'm surrounded by 60 full-grown men who have done everything from drunk driving to murder. The open living unit concept, I think, was nice in the sense that you get greater interaction, but obviously the numbers were, you know, challenging for both inmates and officers. What that means to me is imagine living with 59 other people who you didn't choose to live with. It's not comfortable for anyone. And for the officers, there's obviously a safety element as well, right? So assaults on officers were really high at the time. Assaults amongst inmates were high at the time as well. And that was, you know, back in 2011, that was kind of where we were at. Over the years, counts dropped. And the counts dropped for a few reasons. One, there was other facilities that opened within the province, which dispersed the counts. But two, sadly, the overdose crisis actually took a lot of lives. And that was reflected in the counts within the jails. The positive of the counts going down, though, was that there was more time for interaction. There was less tension. I want to say less violence, but I'm not sure if that's proved by the facts. But also the changes in society were reflected within the institutions where things became more politically correct, I guess, more focused on recovery, more focused on rehabilitation and mental health. And they still have a long way to go in that regard, but I noticed the change definitely in my short career on the living units and on how we operated with the inmates, how we operated programs, how they were treated. There was a lot more respect going both ways by the time I exited my career. There was a lot more programs being taught. The facility that I worked at had introduced case management in around 2017, and I was lucky enough to become a case manager, which was a really, really pleasant experience. That gave me an opportunity to connect with inmates one-on-one and to connect them with resources in the community for their release and resources within the jail for during their stay. So we worked with people like the John Howard Society, which is an amazing organization that offers reintegration services to inmates in custody and also connects them with resources and helps them outside as well. We also had a really great chaplain that offered Buddhist meditation and Buddhist studies and things like that. We had a great school teacher that I connected with, and I offered tutoring to inmates that I could help out. And we also had some programs. So those things were really positive. Seeing those changes was great, but there was also challenges as well. It's hard to shift a staffing culture from warehousing, safety, and security towards rehabilitation and reintegration. Not everybody's going to get on board. And I think there's two streams of thought. Our correction system is divided amongst provincial and federal in Canada. And the federal system does hiring where they actually separate the streams, to my knowledge. They separate the streams from security officers to program officers, and they're hired differently and they're trained differently. Provincial doesn't do that. And I think that there is good staff that are safety oriented that want to be there for response to violent incidents or medical incidents or things like that. And they're very good at that, and they should be utilized for that. And they shouldn't be forced to teach programs that they're not interested in. There's also people who are more social work minded, who like connecting with people, who like teaching people, who like, you know, offering support and services to people. And I think it's maybe better served to separate those two streams and train people accordingly so that the best result is delivered to the inmate and the staff is satisfied with their job, right? So that was one challenge that I found for sure. Another challenge that I found was connecting them with resources. So when I was a case manager, it was extremely eye-opening looking at the lack of resources for inmates as they exited corrections. Because if you're released at court on a Friday at, say, 4 p.m., all the offices are closed. You might not have housing set up. Because when you're in pretrial, you often get released from court, right? So you could be at court in Vancouver. You're given a gray sweatshirt and some gray sweatpants and your Velcro canvas shoes. And you're sent on your way with no belongings, no way to get back to the jail to pick up your belongings, no ID, no house to go to, no nothing. And sadly, that's a reality for a lot of people who are in custody. And that's how people get caught in the cycle of recidivism, because what are you going to do? You have no money, you have nowhere to go. And the only skills you know maybe is break and enter, petty theft, something like that. And that's what you're going to return to survive.
Yeah.
That was really sobering. So what I found I had to do a lot of the time was, because there was such a lack of housing resources for people exiting the system, that I would have to either tell them to basically fake a drug addiction if they didn't have one, or pretend like they were ready to go into recovery if they did have a drug addiction, were not ready to go into recovery, just to get them into a recovery house. Because recovery houses is one of the only housing resources available to inmates leaving the system.
Yeah. So I actually know Kelly.
Oh.
Kelly is the Buddhist monk that works in the prison system.
Yeah.
In her spare time, she also teaches Buddhism.
Yes.
And she actually used to teach in this building.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I can't remember the name of her organization, but
it's
one that teaches Buddhism to and meditation to people. So, because we used to have a youth support program that supported youths, and some of those youths were incarcerated or in for
remand.
Remand, yes. Yeah. So the youth that are in remand, and having them, as you described, released without notice at 4 p.m., sometimes into our custody, and then trying to find housing for them.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to them being released without those resources, they also often have conditions to their release, such as curfew, which when a person is homeless is very hard to comply with.
Yeah.
therefore they're subject to being
breached,
yeah. Which is when they go against those conditions, mm-hmm. and so they're brought back into custody through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
Quite often we would struggle to find housing for a particular youth that we were following.
Yeah.
Everything that you mentioned rings true with our experience here in this community.
Yeah, a lot of what I had to do was just give them a list of shelters, which was really sad because you can lose your life. Like the average stay for provincial inmates, I believe, is about 30 days, which seems like nothing. But in 30 days, you lose the place you're renting. You lose, you know, your job. You lose, maybe on arrest, you lost your ID or that was confiscated and you can't get it back. So your life can really fall apart in 30 days. And for those who stay longer, you know, it's often just a waiting game to see if things go their way at court. But how do you set up for life from inside, right? Getting a case manager and getting John Howard Society into the jails was a huge step. But there's definitely a lot more that can be done. Something that I would really like to see is identification that is valid. So in federal corrections, the identification that they give you when you leave is a valid piece of government identification. In provincial, it's not. So those short provincial stays, they're leaving without any identification, and that's really challenging. John Howard helps out get birth certificates and things like that, which can help get the wheels turning on that. But there's still, you know, a lack of awareness within the jails as well, that that's a step that they maybe need to do before they leave. And I think there's a cost as well to getting the birth certificate, which a lot of them can't afford.
There are sometimes, yeah. So that's actually a really important point because you can't open a bank account.
Yeah.
You can't access social services without that identification. And the first thing you lose as a person without a home is your ID.
Absolutely.
It gets stolen or misplaced, you know, when you're operating in the dark, without light, without a home. So, yeah. So, you know, it would make sense to me for the system to at least ask an inmate, whether they're in remand or sentenced, you know, what is your housing situation? Are you going to a permanent housing or are you in need of housing?
Yeah. Unfortunately, then, beyond that, there needs to be more done in society. And to that point, I actually found, when we're talking about the challenges within the correction system, corrections is a catch-all for the failures of society. That's what I found. So if you look at the numbers and percentages of incarcerated people, Indigenous people highly outweigh every other race within facilities. So that to me shows that we've failed in Indigenous communities and society, and as a result, they have ended up incarcerated because of years of, you know, intergenerational trauma and genocide and everything else, right? Also with that, you know, I can't accurately depict the history of this because it's kind of before my time, but the mental institutions closing down and stuff, you know, Riverview, things like that, that has had a massive impact on the correction system. And the amount of resources they pour into Indigenous programming is it astronomical in comparison to other resources because they have to make up for what society has lacked. And for people with mental health needs, it's the same thing. There's entire units, you know, more than one unit in a facility dedicated to people with mental health needs. And those are the people with the highest mental health needs, when in actuality, almost everyone is suffering from low-level depression, anxiety, you know, different things like that. And the resources are focused solely on the people with the highest needs. I don't want to get into the graphicness of how deeply concerning their behavior can be in that institution. But all those resources are poured into those few because we are, you know, correctional facilities are not designated mental health facilities, which means that they cannot forcibly inject people who require medication. So we go through this terrible cycle where these people have to be certified times two to be shipped out to a mental hospital to be forcibly injected with medication, only to deteriorate, return to custody, and go through the same cycle again. So the remainder of the population that could really do with some counseling, you know, some coping mechanisms, some little bits of help that would really make a huge difference in their lives, they don't tend to get the help that they need because those few with the highest needs that should not be in jail, period, are the ones soaking up resources.
You mentioned earlier on that you've seen a lot of change in the system over your years of being there. Where do you think the corrections industry is heading? And is it a positive or a negative direction?
I think the direction it's heading is usually a reflection of the current political state. So hopefully, you know, not to say that I side with any particular party or anything, but, you know, because things are kind of liberal and left-leaning right now, I feel like things are going in the right direction. Things are going, moving towards rehabilitation, recovery, you know, skill building, things like that. And I think that's going in the right direction. However, if we all of a sudden change political parties and there's a big tough on crime move, that's when things go back to warehousing, programs drop off, you know, and there's much less resources poured into things. So for now, in my opinion, in my years, I watch things move in the right direction. You know, there was a lot more programs, a lot more resources, and a lot more respect.
So what does corrections do particularly well?
I think they're faced with a lot of challenges. So I think they're doing well in the sense that how good can you do when you are plagued with society's problems and you know, not much funding or resources to solve them? So I think overall, you know, there's some, I don't want to name drop, but there's some people that I've worked with over the years that run institutions, and they're very forward thinking and they're very open. The one institution where I did the nonviolent living unit project, that the person who was in charge of that institution at the time was extremely open to suggestion, creativity. I think he was really building something special there, right? So to have people like that in places where they are willing to try new things, they seem to be doing things for the right reason, that's very helpful.
Actually, you know, corrections has had a long history here in Maple Ridge with the Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
One of the founders of our stream stewardship organization, the Alouette River Management Society, was actually a corrections officer.
Yeah.
He just recently passed away. His name was Tom Cadu.
Oh, okay.
And we featured some of the work he's done in previous podcasts.
Yeah,
so there's definitely a role. And in our community network, which is a network of agencies, service agencies here in Maple Ridge,
mm-hmm.
corrections has certainly reached out to those organizations to integrate some of the programs
mm-hmm.
with the community.
And I think that's exactly the direction things need to go, is in program integration, you know, nonprofits and corrections, different things like this organization. And I've seen a lot of that over the years where they get, even if it's work detail projects, right? Like at one point, I remember they had a screen printer and the inmates were screen printing t-shirts and stuff. And, you know, that's a useful skill. That's something that they're learning, you know, even if it doesn't mean that they're going to go be a screen printer, maybe they've learned that they can learn something new, right? Because sometimes as adults, we forget that we can, you know, pick up new hobbies or new work skills and things like that. You know, I think that's the direction things need to move, is innovation and creativity.
So what should we be doing as a society with people who have interacted with the correction system? Is there anything we're doing wrong? Is there anything we could be doing better?
I think just no judgment, right? Like, we've all made mistakes. And, you know, in the feds, they say that, you know, you got to put your papers on the door. And, you know, my sister actually worked as a sewing instructor in federal corrections for a while. And at the time, I was in the beginning of my career, and I was very, I don't want to say anti-inmate, but if you knew me back then and you were wearing red, you probably didn't like me. So I was very hard line at the beginning. And she was very kind and empathetic and compassionate. And it wasn't until years later that when I became a case manager that I kind of swayed my thinking to align with hers. But she used to tell me, if you wrote down a list of the worst things that you ever did and you put them on the door, do you think your neighbors would want to talk to you either? You know, so I think people who have interacted with the justice system and stuff, they just don't want to be judged. You know, so many of them are out here, they're trying their hardest. And, you know, they're our neighbors, right? So treat them with respect. You know, I live in town here, and, you know, we have a pretty transient, high transient homeless population, people suffering with addictions and things like that. And I don't treat them any differently than I treat my neighbors in my building, because they're our neighbors, and they might be on their hard days, and people who have been in the system might be on their hard days, but, you know, we all have them. And just, I think, treat them with kindness and respect and hire them. You know, they need jobs, they need rental units, they need everything just like we do, right? So give them opportunities and let them show you that they're worthwhile, right?
Yeah, the information on trauma has progressed in society in the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any recognition of trauma as the cause of incarceration?
Yeah, you know what? I actually remember specifically when that kind of rhetoric started coming out, when that information started surfacing. It's so funny because that shift was all at the same time. We had this big anti-bullying and harassment shift where it was all of a sudden no longer okay to haze rookies and treat, you know what I mean, say awful things to your coworkers. So we had this cultural shift within the staff at that time. And we also had the shift towards recognition of trauma. And, you know, it was hard to absorb at the time. It was just not something that we had talked about or looked at before, but it's definitely surfacing now. And it's definitely a part of training now, as far as I understand from when I left. It was definitely something that was getting recognized, right? And we had things like substance use, like concurrent disorder counselors, I believe they call them now. So they were teaching like cognitive behavioral therapy on units. And the other one, I don't even think I can pronounce it, dialectical behavioral therapy.
Yes, yeah, DBT. Exactly. CBT and DBT.
Yeah, so they were starting to do a lot of that and a lot of group work and things like that, right? It's just, there's just never enough to go around, right? Because when you're looking at, say, at your highest counts, some of the institutions are 72 inmates to a unit, to one officer. And, you know, at those counts, the one substance use counselor for the entire jail just isn't enough, right?
So what do you think should be done differently?
There should be a concurrent disorders or just any type of counselor available on every unit with a sign-up sheet available to everyone every day. Because how much better would we all be if we could go to therapy, right? And especially when you're dealing with people with, you know, lots of past trauma and different things, you know, to be able to sit and talk to someone, make use of that time, you would be turning out people who are healed, you know, who no longer want to commit crime, who no longer want to terrorize society, that just want to go out and contribute.
Do you know if there are any elder programs in the,
yeah,
in the jails?
Yeah, there is. Most of the jails have like kind of a native liaison is what they would call them. And then they organize things like having elders come in and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, good to hear that. Mm-hmm. I know there is some limited level of literacy assistance as well, mm-hmm. but that seems to be kind of sporadic.
Yeah, the teachers, again, spread very thin, right? One part-time teacher to a jail with a capacity of, you know, 650 inmates really just isn't enough. Education is definitely a barrier and, you know, something that they could make good use of their time in there, right? But again, I also, with all this being said and all the suggestions being made, at the end of the day, most of the studies have shown that recidivism is greatly reduced when people spend their sentences in the community. So things like parole, bail, community supervision orders, those are actually much more effective than incarcerating individuals. If you think about it, you know, when you pluck somebody out who's made a mistake and you put them around 100 other people who have made mistakes, you're obviously not, they're not meeting mentors and learning new skills. And the skills that they're learning are, you know, criminal in nature, right? So
right.
For a lot of them, it becomes networking, it becomes skill building, it becomes exactly what we don't want it to be. So I think jail should be a last resort. I think community supervision orders and restorative justice should be our first priority as a society. If we want a safer society, locking them up and throwing away the key really isn't the answer, because everybody's sentence will end eventually. Everybody will be released eventually. And it's better for us if we can help them build skills, you know, supervise them safely in the community to work through their traumas or their problems, learn new skills and contribute to society.
Yeah, there's, part of that is sort of built into our current system. What I noticed from hours of sitting in court in supporting a youth was that the judge and the prosecutor asked very few questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually the judge would ask what's written on the paper from the charges.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge would ask very few questions to the person being, what's the proper term? At that point, they are not charged with anything. They are, well, they're charged with something, but they're not sentenced.
Yeah, I mean, they're remanded.
Okay, we'll call them person in remand.
Yeah.
And they're given conditions.
Yeah.
Like standard ones are no weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Usually a red zone, mm-hmm. which means they can't go to certain areas if, for example, if they were brought in for shoplifting or mm-hmm. theft under 5,000.
Yeah.
That would usually include all the places where the support organizations are.
Yeah.
At least in the Maple Ridge context.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those, you know, and they're given out routinely without inspection of if you have this, is there anything that contraindicates indicates this condition for you, sir or ma'am, whoever's in the dock? And the few times when I did see a judge ask questions of the prosecutor, this person doesn't seem to have had a criminal record before this. What were they doing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they were housed and employed.
Yeah.
And somehow that makes a difference in how they perceive. We then had an opportunity to ask as supporting people, can you change their red zone? Can you remove the curfew requirement? Because this person does not have housing.
Yeah.
And it had a very different outcome. The breaches went down for this person. Mm-hmm. They started off with three charges. One of them was actually not even a charge that they were guilty of.
Mm-hmm.
The other two were. And they ended up with 17 because of breaches.
Wow. Yeah.
And most of that was due to the fact of being homeless.
Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what you see is when there's unrealistic, you know, expectations placed on someone with no resources to meet those expectations and no advocate to help them speak for themselves. They're put into a situation where it just becomes a revolving door, right? And yeah. I think there's some changes that could happen. You know, I haven't witnessed much of the court system hardly at all. But, you know, you get those secondhand stories when you're talking to them and you hear the frustrations and you hear how, you know, I did 17 courses with you and they didn't look at a single one of them. And, you know, you helped me finish my GED and they didn't even care. And, you know, you helped me set up housing and it didn't matter. I didn't get out anyways. And I can understand that frustration for sure. Right. So.
And then there's the sheer cost, because every time you put a person through court, you've got all the sheriffs that are in the building.
Oh, yeah.
You've got all the clerks that are recording it. You've got the judge's time. You've got the prosecutor, and you've got whoever's representing the person.
Absolutely.
So it's a massive cost to put somebody through it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can eliminate that through a better process, it makes more sense without infringing on the justice.
Mm-hmm. There's still a task that needs to be completed. Absolutely. I agree with you that, you know, the justice system is in place for a reason, and crimes do need to be persecuted to some extent, but we should be looking at how we're doing that and is it working, right?
Yes. Do you have any more thoughts?
Yeah, I just had a couple more notes on things that would be helpful. So when we talked about the structure of the living units and the ratio of inmates to officers, I think that's really important, is reduction in that for both parties, right? It's a safer place for staff. It's a safer place for inmates. It's more tolerable. And a lot more can get done with those smaller ratios. I also think double staffing would be, you know, that was something that we had advocated for a lot of years when I worked there. And that's something that I still feel strongly would be a good option. And maybe pairing up that security officer with that program officer so that you get those dual perspectives and different levels of helping, right? Again, mental health supports, I think it's huge, right? Like we're pouring all these resources into things and we need to make sure that they're reaching the masses, not just that concentrated few. Obviously, if we had better resources for people with serious mental illnesses, it's elsewhere would be really nice. You know, I'm really sick of seeing people incarcerated that shouldn't be there. You know, they just should not be there. It's not fair. It's not right. And, you know, that was really hard to watch. And ultimately, I think for me, when I was in there, my dream for corrections would be a continuum of support. So pairing people up with advocates or guides through the court system so that they can understand what's going on. You know, they can have support as they go through that. And then continuing, you know, if they were to be incarcerated or if they're supervising the community, to start right off with programs, to start right off with counseling, to start right off with skill building, things like that. And then that continuation to the community. So there needs to be a bridge from custody to community where people can be supported, because to be turned out, like we talked about, no housing, no identification, no job offers, no support of any kind, is really just contributing to an unsafe society. So to have some form of housing that is available, that you don't need to be, you know, facing addiction to access, that you don't need to be, you know, facing homelessness to access, just a safe landing spot for these people to get a chance to restart their life and to restart fairly, I think would make the community a much safer place and, you know, do the people justice, right?
Yeah, and some of the costs of this will be recuperated through the reduction of recidivism.
Exactly, exactly. Because just turning people out with nothing is just contributing to putting someone back through the whole cycle again, right? So if we can stop it with a little investment and make it the end of the line instead of the beginning of, you know, the cycle again, would be a huge difference maker.
Yeah. How can people in the community support the correction system? What can be done from the community stance?
Oh, I think, more or less the answer that I gave about, you know, rent your apartment suite, your basement suite to them, or offer them a job, or, you know, we would do training inside about preparing for job searches and stuff. And there was a whole module about how to not hide your past, but how to answer those questions. Do you lie? Do you hide it? You know, and they would tell them, be honest and whatnot. But I mean, we're at least in a better place now where there are so many jobs on the market that there's a higher likelihood that they'll be hired. But back in 2011, when I first got the job in corrections, there was hardly any jobs at that time, right? So if you're coming out at a time like that, what are the chances that you're getting hired, right? So definitely, I think just treating people with kindness and respect. And I think society is really at that point now where we don't judge people based on one mistake. You know, we're much more open-minded and empathetic and kind and compassionate, caring. So I think just continue to do that, right? Treat people with kindness and respect and understand that we all make mistakes. And I'm proud to call some former inmates my close friends now. And, you know, it's nice to be in a position where I can do that, where I can support people. So I encourage you to do the same.
Right.
Thank you so much. You gave so many amazing answers, and we're really thankful to have you on our podcast.
Thank you.
Make sure to tune in for our next episode. So you've talked about all of your service in the correction system. What's next for you?
So I'm really excited because in leaving behind my career in corrections, I'm now embarking on a career as an entrepreneur. So I am a couple weeks away from opening a tiny cafe in Port Coquitlam. And it's kind of inspired by corrections because when I was a case manager, I had the opportunity to teach programs. And in one of the programs I was teaching, there was the story of two wolves. It's a Cherokee legend, which is about, you know, a grandfather and his grandson sitting down by the river. The grandfather is awfully quiet. So the grandson asks him why he's so quiet. And he says, two wolves fight inside me. One wolf is vengeful, angry, and violent. And the other is kind, compassionate, and caring. And the boy says, well, which one wins? And he says, the one I feed. So I've kind of opened up a tiny little cafe inspired by that. So it's called the Good Wolf Cafe & Co. And it's at the Go Wash car wash station in Port Coquitlam. It's super little and it's all takeout. But we're hoping to donate a portion of our proceeds to charity. And in the future, when I'm looking to hire, I'm going to try to hire people facing barriers to employment. So people that have been through the system or other things like that. And hopefully grow from there and provide opportunities and, you know, be a contributing member of the community out there, right?
What an amazing way to support your community. So to all of our Port Coquitlam listeners, please stop by and check out Jerrica's new cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on our podcast.
Thank you so much.
And that concludes this episode of Seed Pod. Seed Pod is brought to you by the Seed Center Society, a registered charity dedicated to community education on environment and development. Our mission is to connect people to community and foster an understanding of sustainable living so that all living beings can thrive. Seed Pod is supported by our listeners, people like you who want to make our communities more resilient. You can sign up as a patron on our Patreon site for as little as $3 a month. Find us at patreon.com/seedpod. You'll find the Seed Center website at www.seedcenter.com. Check out the programs at our neighborhood house and community gardens. Our featured program for this episode is our community computer program. We provide free internet access with computers, a printer, and scanner, so that people who face the digital divide can access online services, find jobs and housing, and prepare resumes. We also provide basic email and browsing training. The episode was hosted by Alicia, an avid hockey player, and me, Christian Cowley. I also recorded and edited the sessions. that's it for us. Thanks for listening. So long, and remember that connected community is a resilient community.